San Diego sector during the entire Anastasio's killing and the beginnings of the cover-up. His signature is on some of the on a subpoena that was filed by the Border Patrol to take Anastasio's medical records before they could be given to the police department. He also one of the things that our reporting and investigation around this film revealed was the existence of these critical incident teams, these off-the-books investigative teams that report directly to, outside of the normal chain of command, report directly to sector leadership, which would have been at that time Rodney Scott, among others. So he knew about this case, and he has the details of the case fresh in his mind when we talk to him, many, many years later in this film. He says he denies many things and he contests many things, but he's on camera talking about this and being forced to address this, I think, maybe for the first time.
Rick Rowley, I want to thank you for being with us. This is a very important documentary. Rick is director of the new HBO documentary premiering tonight. It's called Critical Incident. And you can see all our interviews on the killing of Anastasio over the years, including with his wife and an eyewitness, at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign, now through December 31st.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Rumble on the River, presenting their 28th community forum, What's the Deal with Data Centers, on Wednesday, January 7th at 825 Northwest 18th Avenue. Doors and info tables at 5:30 p.m. and community panel at 6:30 p.m. More info available at 350pdx.org/event.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Thanks for being with us. This is a very special edition of the KBOO Evening News. It's the best of 2025. From December 24th through January 2nd, we'll be featuring some of our favorite news stories from the past year. I'm Althea Billings, news director here at KBOO, and I'm so pleased to get to showcase some of our work from 2025. Before we do, gotta remind you that KBOO is in our end-of-year campaign. If you'd like to support local, volunteer-produced news reporting, consider donating to KBOO. Every dollar counts. You can go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you. On this Best of the KBOO News 2025, we will be taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from KBOO reporter and interim news director, Hannah Francis. Take it away, Hannah.
June 5th marks 5 years since Don't Shoot Portland's successful lawsuit against the City of Portland and the Trump administration, demanding a change to police training, limiting their use of munitions, protecting the right to protest in Portland, and putting PPB's consistent violations on the record. In remembrance, the Black Gallery is hosting an immersive exhibit in partnership with Donovan Scribes and Portland Mercury's special blackout issue, a retrospective of Portland's racial justice protests. I spoke with Teresa Rayford, the founder of Don't Shoot PDX, to talk about the remembrance. Will you tell me a brief overview of how the lawsuit came about?
Oh, yeah. Well, obviously, protesters were being assaulted, excessive force, and chemical weapons were being used against people for exercising their First Amendment right to free speech. And all of that was being done during a global pandemic. So obviously, you know, there's a risk of harm, a risk of loss of life. And as someone who has, you know, felt the violence that happens to people that are, you know, standing up for people of color, I've experienced the violence that happens when the state intervenes with your right to protest. And yeah, at the time I thought that it was important to kind of like put the science first, so that even if they didn't care about what the demands were, or they weren't valuing the lives of the people that were, you know, seeking recourse or some type of response or accountability for the murders of so many people, that they would think of the science and the implications and the health hazards that affect everyone. And maybe that would give them the consideration, or at least the kind of understanding of what was happening with the global pandemic and the use of outdated chemicals in some cases against people during a pandemic. Maybe they would think like, oh, we're actually harming people, because it's obvious with the use of violence against us that I've experienced, they don't see us as human. So with the science report, we tried to humanize the association of violence against people. And, you know, like you said, it was a successful endeavor. We were able to initially stop the city from using the gas, the tear gas, and the use of force. And then, you know, obviously there was a federal response, so we utilized the same information, science, and inspiration to kind of stop the federal response a couple of months after, so, which also, you know, stopped the violence. And
J. Ashley Albies, one of the attorneys that helped Don't Shoot PDX win the case, told me about some of the details of the lawsuit.
In the wake of George Floyd's murder on May 25th of 2020, protests, as you know, broke out around the country, around the world, and police across the country responded with aggressive and unconstitutional force in response to those mass protests, and that occurred here in Portland as well. The protests in Portland started on about May 29th, and they continued every night for about 100 nights. Shortly after the protests started, Don't Shoot Portland reached out to a group of lawyers, myself included, along with Jesse Merrithew of Levy Merrithew Horst and Oregon Justice Resource Center folks, including Juan Chavez. And we talked about, is there anything we can do to address the tear gas that the Portland Police Bureau was using en masse against peaceful protesters? And we tried to think about what we could do. We were hearing from community members that were being impacted. This is also in the context of the COVID-19 outbreak, where people were forced inside or to wear masks when they were in spaces together. But nonetheless, protesters filled the streets of Portland, often peacefully, and were subjected to tear gas and other munitions by the Portland police trying to shut down these protests. So a few days after the protests broke out, on June 5th, we filed a complaint styled as a class action complaint and sought a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order limiting the use of force by the Portland Police Bureau against community members. Don't Shoot was the lead plaintiff in that case, and several community members joined that lawsuit because they were injured and were seeking to represent the class of people who were injured by the Portland Police Bureau. A few days after we filed that complaint and we filed a motion for a temporary restraining order, which would limit the use of tear gas, the city opposed this motion, but the court heard oral argument on it a few days later. And on June 9th, the court, federal court, granted a temporary restraining order that was initially supposed to be for 14 days, but substantially limited the Portland Police Bureau's use of tear gas. This is significant. Throughout June and July and the next couple months, we filed amended complaints. We were adding plaintiffs, adding and expanding the type of use of force that we were challenging and trying to limit by the Portland Police Bureau. So it started as a temporary restraining order against tear gas, and it morphed into challenges and limitations on the Portland Police Bureau's use of impact munitions, the so-called less lethal weapons, pepper spray, the LRAD device, sound cannons, flashbangs, rubber ball distraction devices, these kind of what they call as less lethal weapons but are incredibly dangerous and harmful. We also ended up getting some restrictions ordered by the court on those types of weapons used against peaceful protesters as well. Eventually, we were able to file a motion for contempt against the Portland Police Bureau and the city for violating these court orders that limited the use of force. The court found that the city and the police bureau were in contempt for violating some of these court orders and ordered some remedies that I'll talk about in a second. But during the course of this litigation, documents came out of when the parties exchange information, it's called discovery. Documents came out of discovery that reflected a very offensive training slide deck that Portland Police Bureau had been giving to its officers. One of the primary documents that got the most attention was the prayer for the alt-right. It was a training slide that was pretty offensive and said really negative things about people engaged in First Amendment activity. There were other portions of that training which were pretty racist. And the plaintiffs, we received those documents during the course of litigation and were about to file them with the court. The city decided to release those documents themselves to try and get out in front of it, which caused a tremendous amount of public outrage. They spread far and wide as there was a lot of documentation about the use of force against protesters, and the training that the Bureau had provided to its officers of this offensive material really only contributed to the frustration and outrage amongst the community about this use of force. We eventually won the motion for contempt, and as a remedy, the court ordered additional training for members of the police bureau that were using these types of weapons against the public. The court directed an internal affairs investigation into some of the instances of the violation of the court order. And Portland Police Bureau had to circulate the court order with all Portland Police Bureau members. They had to certify that they read it and understood the order. There was additional training on use of force at the protest that was ordered by the court. And the what are called the grenadiers, the officers who police some of these protests, had to demonstrate, the ones that use these less lethal weapons, had to demonstrate compliance with the court order and demonstrate that they understood the reporting requirements. Throughout the case, we were continually going back and forth with the city and continuing to get information and litigate. We filed a motion for class certification, which was eventually denied, but in that denial, the court identified some serious concerns. He denied it based on the class, a kind of technical legal issue, but he did note, the court did note, that there were substantial concerns about the Bureau's pattern and practice of use of force during protests, in particular against people engaged in peaceful protest. Ultimately, the parties were able to secure a resolution that included a monetary sum to some of the named plaintiffs, one whole dollar to Don't Shoot Portland as an organization. But in particular, we were able to secure a very strong injunction for 14 months, which limited the Portland Police Bureau's use of tear gas, of impact munitions, of rubber ball distraction devices. In addition, the Portland Police Bureau was forced to decommission all remaining inventory of RBDDs. We obtained an injunction that limited the use of aerosol restraints, and as well as the long-range acoustical devices, the LRAD, was limited in its scope and how it could be used. And that was in place for 14 months after the entry of this judgment. And subsequent to that, the parties filed a pretty massive motion for attorney's fees and were able to recover attorney's fees for the work that we had done.
You said that these were in place for 14 months after the suit was filed. Are any of these things still in place?
Well, the rubber ball, the RBDDs were ordered to be decommissioned, all the remaining inventories, and so that is something that people should be watching. The injunction itself lasted 14 months, but if those pop up again, we have this case to look to show that they were being used inappropriately during the time the time during the protest related to George Floyd. And I think that all of these pieces of the injunction, while they have expired, helps create a framework. If moving forward these uses of forces pop up again, we have all of this litigation and this history to show that the Bureau used these weapons inappropriately against peaceful protesters. And if they continue to engage in that conduct, we have this to look back on and show a pattern of conduct.
I asked Teresa how they were planning on celebrating the five-year anniversary, and she reminded me that this is no celebration.
There's not a lot to celebrate when you're thinking about, like, the violence that's perpetrated against people, parents being murdered, and especially now with, you know, the fact that, you know, we have neighbors that are being kidnapped and lots of people that are emboldened with white supremacist ideology and violence. There's nothing to celebrate, really. We're just mostly reflecting on the 5 years since then, and with reflection comes contemplation. You know, what do you do next? How do you organize? How do you rebuild a community so that you can be strong in supporting, you know, people that are going to be vulnerable over the next, you know, probably generation based on the work that's happening with this new administration? So
what is Don't Shoot PDX working on right now?
Well, right now, on the other side of our gallery, we actually have our annex. And we're working with a few students, art students from PNCA, to build a art pop-up right around the corner from the art gallery, which will again serve to help support Black artists in their communities and our vulnerable community that we already advocate for. At our location, we do like food distros and things of that sort. We give away a lot of free supplies to children and families. And we do a lot of direct advocacy work for families affected by violence. So this year we're going to be opening up the space a little bit more. On the 18th and 19th, we're going to be doing art making with PNCA, which is our art school partners. They're at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, and we'll also be celebrating Juneteenth at the Blackout. Another thing that came up is we just recently moved into the Center of Social Justice with Seating Justice, and we have a suite there, which is set up as a memory lab. A lot of people know that our work with Liberated Archives, which includes like research, that's helped us kind of develop our opportunities to file these lawsuits and to advocate for our communities and to audit agency and policies that are harming us. And so having access to our own memory lab where we can invite people to come in and utilize research or, you know, thumb through our cultural library or make copies or prints or, you know, whatever they need to do to kind of process documents and materials that would otherwise be like banned or lost or censored. We wanted to make that space available to our community. So it'll be opening this Juneteenth, and it's on 510 Southwest 3rd, and it will be by appointment only.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Where can Portlanders go to learn more and get involved with you folks?
For our website, don'tshootpdx.org, and then also for the Black Gallery, it's theblackgallerypdx.com.
There is this interactive exhibit with Donovan Scribes at the Black Gallery. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So Donovan approached me to be interviewed for this work that he's doing with Portland Mercury. And we actually held the interview, which was videotaped at our art gallery, the Black Gallery in Northwest Portland. And because of the type of exhibits that we've done, centering the different things that we associate with in our organizing, I thought that it would be incredible to kind of establish an exhibit that, you know, showed what he was putting together for readers. I thought because there were parts of it that I consider art, especially like the photography and poetry and things of that sort, that having it showcased in a public space, since there aren't like protests and things happening now, that it will give you more levels and textures for reflection. People could come to a space and take quiet time or come in and ask questions or share thoughts or just kind of be reminded and use that reminder as a call to action. And so that's what we did with the exhibit. I noticed early on in my activism that when I was out, you know, protesting, that when we had signs or banners or things that kind of spoke to why we were out there, that it it would take people a moment to kind of digest that, and then they would want to process and learn more. And so I'm hoping that that's what happens with this exhibition, that people will be, you know, mindful that just because you're not protesting doesn't mean that you can't center social change.
Is there anything else that you'd like to get out there?
I think that connection to community is more important than ever, and that if people are reflecting on their involvement in protest or organizing, that if they need support, we have like mental health support available through some of the people in our network. There's a program called Protest with Purpose. When we're reflecting, there's a lot of reintroduction to trauma. And so we just want to encourage people to kind of like reach out and get help. And if you got to contact us to get a referral, you know, contact us at contact@don'tshootpdx.org, and we'll do legal referrals or mental health referrals for people that need a little bit of support. And thanks for asking that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your work and your time, Teresa.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News. It's the best of 2025. Today, I'm sharing some of my most notable reporting from the last year. Building off the last story, I had the opportunity to speak with Donovan Scribes about his five-year retrospective on the George Floyd protests. He spoke about creating the Portland Mercury Blackout Edition and why it's so important to keep telling and reading these stories. I'm Anna Francis. Today, I'm joined by Donovan Scribes, award-winning writer, producer, and communications consultant based in Portland, Oregon. He's the curator and editor of the recent Portland Mercury Special Blackout Edition, a five-year retrospective on the murder of George Floyd and Portland's racial justice protests of 2020. He's also the creator of an accompanying exhibit currently at the Black Gallery in downtown Portland. Hi, Donovan. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm just going to acknowledge all the work that went into this retrospective. It's an anthology of so many really powerful and beautiful Black minds and experiences. How did you start this project, and what was the process of getting these folks together like?
Yeah, it really just being here in Portland and obviously seeing the protests unfold and the messaging coming from those 100 plus days start to get unwound before the first year was away from us. And definitely as we're getting into year 3, 4, and obviously 5 now, I just was frustrated with seeing how those narratives were getting lost around not just the police and defunding the police and those type of things, but just general respect around Black prosperity. And so I've been marinating on the fact that that five-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder was coming up. May 25th, 2025 is when he's murdered. That's not actually when the public became aware of his murder, but I just wanted to make sure that as we are coming into that anniversary, that we as a community had space to reflect on that, you know, because it was the largest global movement for Black lives in America's history and global history. So that shouldn't be just treated with some of the ways that we interact as community now, just with like throwing up posts and things like that. I wanted to make sure we got that weight of the moment. And so it really just came as me approaching the Portland Mercury, who I already had a relationship with and had been working for in different capacities in terms of writing. And I told them my idea and told them that what I really was seeing was not just to have one writer or two writers and have it just be centered on one voice. I wanted it to be kind of a chorus and Black voices to talk about 2020 and what it meant and what it meant for us 5 years later, and for it not to necessarily be all the same angles, but to be able to approach it from a myriad of different lenses, so that when people did look back on this anniversary, that they got to hear from us unfiltered, and that's kind of where it all stemmed from. We moved from there.
So this moment, the 2020 protests, I think were, you know, an important continuation and evolution of this crucial racial justice movement, which you mentioned was the biggest in the world. I'm curious about what you see the role of that time and the role of this specific moment playing in the overall storyline of the racial justice movement.
Yeah, and when I say the largest, it's literally just the scale of the protests. What we got to remember, of course, Portland was one of the epicenters because of how long we continued to protest here in Portland, but this was everywhere. It was like Italy, it was France, it was in different countries throughout Africa, it was in Russia, it was in cities, it was in little towns and suburbs. Like, this was not an isolated thing by any means. And, you know, one of the writers in Blackout, Lakiana Drury, he has a piece in there called Dreams in a Vase with No Water. And that piece is kind of him reflecting on a couple kids that he has worked with. And it's really just a story of taking them to a Zupans and the isolation of going to pick some flowers for these kids. But he's relating it to how kids are able to dream or not dream in this city, and reflecting back on 2020. And anyways, he has a program called Word is Bond, where he just took the kids out to Ghana. And he was just posting it on Instagram yesterday. So he's going to meet the ambassadors out there in Ghana and sharing Blackout with them. And the ambassador was sharing that, you know, for him, George Floyd was the first time that he had actually stepped out to go to any demonstration himself as an adult. And, you know, that's really the type of things that I'm talking about ultimately, is that this was such a global movement to recognize that in America, especially, Black people have been demonized and had our dreams obfuscated by policy, by culture, by those things intertwining. This felt like, for a moment at least, that we were recognizing that this has been a 400-year tradition in the country, and there's never been any point in the country where we've let go of that tradition. It's been an ongoing thing. And that's not to say that nothing has changed, because I don't believe in that. That doesn't give credit to the myriad and long list of people who have continued to make sure that that is not true. But what is true is that America has never let go of the foundational things that have kept Black people in the positions that we've been in this country, that make statistics around anything from education to housing to law enforcement interactions being deadly or leading to deadly outcomes, continue to be so high. And so in that, you know, to me, Blackout is a part of that tradition. Is that, you know, part of how these stories, part of how these things are allowed to continue is by quieting the stories, changing the stories, changing the narrative around what actually happened. And that's why I wanted to make sure that there were 12 distinct voices inside of this piece, inside of Blackout. So there's 12 different essays and interviews where people can get a snapshot into how Black Portland felt at this anniversary point. Because otherwise it would have been, who knows where it would have been in terms of how our narrative would be held. And so I just wanted to make sure that wasn't lost. And especially at a time right now where we have coming through our federal government a purposeful obfuscating of our stories and silencing of our stories, it's even more important to make sure that those things don't get lost. because what that movement is about is making sure that people are scared to even tell their stories as well.
You also mentioned that you'd very intentionally place the stories in the order that they were. What was kind of the shape of the story that you're trying to create?
Yeah, I ultimately was just trying to create a narrative arc for people. So like Devin Boss, his piece, Ghost Town, Fronting the Revolution, you know, Devin and I now for a couple years have worked on different projects together. And, you know, I knew of Devin before I actually knew Devin through music, but he had kind of pivoted towards filmmaking. And before he was kind of on the filmmaking side, he was really stepping out in 2020 and helping front these different protests. And in particular, like, you know, he had been working with my partner before he and I started working together. And I just heard how heavy like 2020 had weighed on him. And, you know, as I got to know him a little bit more, just hearing how much this ultimately, like, he was compelled to go outside, not by anything other than just being a Black man raised here in Northeast Portland. And then he ended up finding himself at the front of these protests. And then also, you know, feeling erased in that same protest movement, and how those things kind of mirrored the exact feeling that, like, a lot of us, like, I'm born and raised here in Portland, fourth generation, and just kind of mirrored that feeling of being erased in our own neighborhoods, being erased in our own experiences, being erased in our own narratives. And that was something that was heavy, you know? And so I just wanted him to kick things off, to talk about those things, to remind people that this is rooted in a real human experience, you know, and there's real, like, human collateral on the other side of these things. And him being able to even, like, share that history and memory with people, I think is important. And, you know, it to me, it pairs so well with ultimately where Lakiana takes it, with talking about Black kids getting to dream in this city, you know, or not, and the different options that are available or not to Black kids, whether that's literally available to you or just silently, covertly told it's not available to you. And then that ultimately kind of dovetails well with what Chris Lambert was sharing in his piece of being a kid here in Northeast Portland and having his, you know, having shot a gun that led to him getting 18 years. Now we can talk about if 18 years is the right amount of years. We could talk about prisons and if that's the right way to treat somebody when they've shot a gun. But nonetheless, he's talking about that reflection, you know, from his cell, you know, because he wrote the majority of that piece while he was locked up. And it then leads into what Jenny Moore was sharing with her piece about being a good villager. You know, she had such a different take on 2020, talking about being a mom. You know, she was pregnant when she wrote this piece, and she already had a three-year-old, but she had a three-year-old daughter and she was pregnant with the son. And so that kind of folded into this idea, because Chris was talking about how little he felt held by different people. And she's talking about how important it is to hold people, and hold our children and hold our mothers and our fathers, like, and how visceral it is at the end of the day that George Floyd, you know, as he's being murdered by a crowd of people, or not by a crowd of people, but in front of a crowd of people, and screaming out for his mother as a 44, 45 year old man, you know, in his last moments. And so I won't go through all of the different pieces in that way, but to me, even though everybody wasn't in the same room, the pieces fit well, and I kind of asked everybody to take on a slightly different piece of the pie, so that when it all was said and done, as you read through this magazine, it's not really just like, oh, I'm going to flip to this person and that person because that headline is interesting to me. It really is told like a book, like or like an album, like a front to back. Each piece leads into the next piece, and you know, I have my intro in there, and my outro is my essay, Symbols Matter, and I reflect on ultimately that moment that so many of us have seen, the die-in on the Burnside Bridge and 10,000 plus people on that bridge. You know, that was pretty compelling to me, seeing that happening and watching it unfold on Facebook Live, and thinking for a moment, like, maybe people are actually starting to get this thing. Like, maybe people are starting to get it on some level. You know, I've been pretty pessimistic about that generally, if people get it. But you know, people will often talk about things are symbolic, like that was just symbolic, it doesn't matter. But symbols, ultimately, they do matter. They play out in our lives every day. You know, I have a line in there where I'm talking about, like, if I see somebody with a swastika, it's a symbol, and that lets me know a lot about that person very quickly. So, you know, symbols do matter. It's just like, if things are only symbolic without action, then that's kind of where we get lost in the sauce, is if you're only throwing up a Black Lives Matter sign, or if you're only putting up a Facebook post, or if you're only saying things are important to you, but you're not practicing it in your everyday spirit, then that's where the things get lost. And I think that's how ultimately a narrative gets lost. And I think that's how we can dovetail from 2020, abolish the police, defunding the police being on the table, to 2021 in Portland and People for Portland being able to, like, say, no, actually, to support racial justice, we need 300 more police. To support racial justice, we need to be sweeping more people in Portland. To support racial justice, we need to be forcing more people into treatment, despite the fact that, like, things like Measure 110 were just getting stood up, and organizations, Black organizations especially, that have never had funding, or organizations that were able to start through that and actually do the things that were getting many, many more people into treatment. Those things were being stood up actively at the same time. Those things were being obfuscated by narratives like a People for Portland. And so ultimately, People for Portland is a great demonstration of matching their symbols with their actions, for the worse.
Yeah. So 5 years later, when we say abolish the police, what do we mean?
Yeah, ultimately, you know, to me, abolition is a hopeful outlook on things. You know, for me, I'm, like I said, I'm fourth generation Portland. I had spent a lot of my years in Northeast Portland, 42nd in Killingsworth, 42nd in Sumner. Then I was on 82nd, or just off of 82nd. But I was going to school in the suburbs, and at least for my middle and high school years. And so for my middle and high school years, I was not just going to school in the suburbs, but I was going to school in, like, the best school in the state, Oregon Episcopal School. And so, like, OES is, like, very wealthy, on acres, in the West Hills. And the difference between going from, like, around 82nd to that school every day was, like, super palpable to me. It was kind of alienating in many ways, but one of the things that was, like, always kind of there's not, like, a heavy police presence around OES. There's also many amenities in the West Hills. There's many things that people have in terms of resource that's available to them. You know, I had peers and friends even that had, for their summers, for example, like they were going to go fly their planes, and so it's a matter of resource versus my mom working overtime at TriMet to the detriment of her body to keep me at that school with the hope that I would end up at a place that would allow me better opportunities than she had, but the neighborhood we were in was not the neighborhood that I was going to school in. And 82nd had no shortage of police. It also had no shortage of poverty. I wouldn't place ourselves in that realm. We weren't impoverished. I would actually say I had a pretty middle-class upbringing inside of it all. But when you look at the whole of the picture, it was pretty stark when I was a child going to school there and living where I lived. And today, it's still pretty stark if you go to 82nd and you go to the West Hills. And the way that law enforcement interacts in those different environments is pretty clear to me. And so when we're talking about abolition, to me, it's those kind of like mirrors of each other of like, how do you resource a community to not be harassed around race and poverty, essentially? And that we have those examples available to us in communities that are well-resourced. And those resources came by way of like very purposeful planning through years and years and traditions, and that, like, for example, like Oregon Episcopal School, that school before it landed in the West Hills with its acres, it was on the same site that City Hall in Portland is today. Like, that shows kind of the ties of what legacies exist between certain places and what legacies don't exist in others. So I think, to me, abolition feels very practical in terms of all the things. I'd also say, like, for me, I have been a journalist. I don't practice anymore, though, like, it's still in my spirit. I've moved more into like essay writing and things like that. But, I used to work with Lisa Loving being my editor at the Scanner. And, I actually just wrote an essay for their 50th anniversary piece, talking about how I was reporting during like the height of the Black Lives Matter movement becoming. And during that time, I had a lot of different questions myself and spent a lot of my time investigating police in relation to me and to my community and where I would land with all of those things. And so I spoke regularly to the Portland police at that time just for quotes and like clarification on things that they were putting out. I even did a ride along with the police at one point. And, even just with the Gresham police, I had even did a Q&A with them about, what does this term gang related mean? And when do you use it or when do you not use it? Why do you even put it out there? What's your criteria? What's your rubric? And what produced from me just interviewing them is that they had no rubric. And so the rubric is whether you say something is gang related or you put out to the media that it's possibly gang related, you're putting out a dog whistle to so many people, and it's a purposeful dog whistle in my view of things. And so for me, I will say, like, abolition to me also didn't come by way of just like a whim. It was coming from real life experience, from being a journalist and just being curious around these different data points that only kind of continue to lay you to a certain conclusion in my mind. And I think Max Smith's piece, For I See No Other Way, I love the title of his essay, but that's exactly what his essay is in Blackout, is talking about, I don't see another way. And he's kind of laying out the case for why. And in my, in my lens is kind of the case for like why this guy is blue too. But I'm willing to have conversation with people about those things, because I will say myself, I didn't always see that the sky was blue on the case of abolition. So I think it's it definitely has a lot of things that people have questions around. And I think many of those questions are valid.
Something that's also a through line in a lot of the stories is, here we are 5 years later with a president who wants to be a dictator in power, and a bunch of people are kind of sticking to themselves. And like Christopher Lambert says in his essay, returning to a system that was never built for us to win. There was so much reckoning and then loss of follow through there. What does this anthology communicate about complacency, or I guess complicity?
Yeah, I think it's ultimately, to me, you got to stay vigilant. You have to like continue to be in movement with a level of purpose tied to these things. I think for me, like obviously being in Skinnaman, like Black life is not a trend, you know, it's not, but it is important to remain diligent in these ways. And I guess for not just white folks, but all of us, we have to like continue checking ourselves and seeing if we're being a part of the systems that have been put in front of all of us. And the systems, like sometimes are people like, fight the system. And I get where that comes from, but the system is just people. Like the system is us, all of us. And so we have to be aware of what governments and businesses are doing, of course, but we have to be aware of what we're doing and how we choose to show up or not in terms of like how these systems continue to impact our general lives.
You've been listening to an in-depth interview with Donovan Scribes, curator and editor of the Portland Mercury's recent Blackout edition. This is a KBOO Evening News special, the best of 2025. I'm Hannah Francis. It is also KBOO's end-of-year campaign, so if our reporting has meant something to you this year, consider supporting KBOO. 80% of our funds come from members, and you could be one of them. kboo.fm/give is the online link to donate, or you can also text KBOO to 44321. Next, I got to speak with Jarrett Work about his reporting for Underscore Native News, about the first full descent of the Klamath River since it was undammed. I am joined by Underscore Native News reporter Jarrett Work.
Jarrett Work. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. My on-air white clay name is Thaynakya. My English name is Jarrett Work, and I'm a reporter and photographer with Underscore Native News.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Of course. So the article that we're going to talk about today is titled Global Solidarity at the Mouth of the Klamath. Could you first give us a little bit of background about the history of dams on the Klamath and the recent undamming?
Right. So there has been a series of dams that have gone up on the Klamath River, you know, for over 100 years at this point. And just this past fall, four of those seven dams were removed in allowing the river to free flow. There's a couple of dams that are still up, but they are similar to like the natural rock features that used to hold water back up towards the headwaters of the river. And this past summer, last month actually, Native youth, Indigenous youth from across the world came together to share this moment together and to really live out their ancestors' prayers. You have to think about how these dams have disconnected the people that have been living along the Klamath, like I was saying, for thousands of years. And this moment is, you know, like what they've been preparing for with like the Salmon Wars and all these other things that the Native nations along the river have been fighting for these past decades, you know, generations at this point. And I was able to attend the tail end of the descent. I think we were on the river for about 4 or 5 days. I don't even remember how many days it was. They all just blended together. But it was really amazing to see these kids that have been paddling for nearly a month on the river, right? Like, not having access to showers, not having access to like a good bed to sleep in. And these kids would still wake up every day and just be so excited to be able to do this, to be able to experience this moment together, and to like just be out connecting with the land and with the river that has helped, that has been the lifeline to their people since forever. You know what I mean? And I had an amazing time. We collaborated with the Oregon Public Broadcasting to put together a couple of different stories. This one was the third, second or third, I don't even remember at this point. It's just been a blur. I'm pretty sure this was like the third story to come out from that collaboration. And we are, after this interview, we're going to OPB to work with Jesse Sears, the Indigenous Affairs producer over there, to watch the film that OPB filmed. So they were able to join from the initial descent from the headwaters in Southern Oregon and followed a couple of different times, different trips, you know, jumping in on the river wherever they were at. And it was really cool because Jessie's also Indigenous. She's a Karuk woman. And for her to be able to collaborate with her on this story that I know means a lot to her as a Karuk person was just so much fun. And I definitely one of the top things of my reporting.
This, obviously, like you're saying, was like an international story and an international event. People came from all over the world to participate, including, you know, some of those youth. Can you tell me specifically about Puran and her experience of kayaking the Klamath, like why she went?
Of course. So a little bit before that, the youth that were participating in the descent, they did that through the Paddle Tribal Waters Program, which is underneath the organization, the nonprofit organization, Rios to Rivers. And they had been working with kids in the Klamath Basin for about 4 years at this point. And these students that were involved were able to attend Indigenous-based, like Indigenous-centered curriculum in places like Chile, and to travel to like Bolivia, and also through some of the other programs, like go to Africa and Canada to be able to learn how to whitewater raft down the free flowing river, you know, like because of the dams were still in place during through this whole process. A lot of the kids didn't even like had never really seen the river moving the way it is now. And like they didn't have access, like Lyric was talking about in her reporting, like the access to outdoors. You have to think about kayaking as this sport, because it is a sport, right? But also Native people have been connected with the rivers and have been traveling through the rivers. Like those were ancestral highways. So it's like Native people had the connection with the river, but then when the dams came up and colonization came in, that starts that disconnect. And a lot of these kids, before even joining Paddle Tribal Waters, had never even stepped foot in a kayak. And now they went 310 miles down the largest dam removal project in the world. And they were able to connect with people through the Kayaking Moon initiative in Chile, where Puran and some of the other youth that were there. But then there was also Indigenous youth from New Zealand that came to be able to participate and witness this, because what is happening here in the United States with colonization, it's just like in the impacts that Native people have with the government and a lot of the different things that are happening when it comes to rivers and dams going up. A lot of Indigenous communities across the world are just now starting to see that, to see the impacts. Like in Chile, they are constructing dams that are huge. And that causes a lot of issues because they're not really informing the public. Like a lot of people will be out fishing on the river or just out on the river, and then they'll let some of the floodwaters out of the dams in Chile, and a lot of people pass that way. Like they end up you know, drowning in the waters once they're released. And so for Perron and some of the other people, it was really important for them to see that it is possible for dams to be removed, that it is possible that their communities will one day see this, even though it's been a 100-plus-year-long fight for the Klamath Basin nations. But that still gave them hope, and that was a lot of the things that Perron had shared through her translator, that she was just really excited to be there and to see this moment and to witness history and to be able to take all of the things that she learned back home so that they can continue to fight the fight against the dams and their access to water.
Thank you for that. Yeah, you mentioned that there are some people from New Zealand and even some from China as well.
It was crazy seeing just like, and it wasn't a huge group of people. It grew from the start. I think it started out with maybe a little over a dozen. I think there was about 17 kayakers at the beginning when they went in to the mouth, and then there was over 100 something at the final landing at the mouth of the Klamath River in below Rekwa Village. And one of the youth, Kia Wiki, I think is her name. She's Maori and from the Klamath Basin. So for her to be able to have people from both of her homelands come together to be able to experience this moment was really special. And hearing those women and men that came from New Zealand and talking about the work that they're doing with similar issues with their government and how they're really trying to come after their sovereignty and things of that sort. So it was so inspiring to be able to witness everything, like the solidarity and talking about like this film, you know, global solidarity at the mouth of the Klamath. Like these people came together to write a demand letter and to create this accord where they're holding these systems of power accountable so that the dams that are in place can come down and no future dams will go up.
Another really important person in this whole project is Danielle Frank, who's the Director of Development and Community Relations for Rios to Rivers. Will you talk a little bit about her backstory and why she does what she does?
Right. Danielle Frank. This kid is... She is so amazing, and I could literally listen to her talk all day long. I'm like, I could tell that you were raised by community. I could tell that you were raised with your grandmas and your grandpas and stuff, because you are literally a 21-year-old elder. And one of the things that she got, like the youth along the trip kept teasing her about, is that she is an elder, but she just has so much knowledge and so much desire to just do good by her community and to really give back to the people that raised her. And I met Danielle a couple of years ago now, and she was one of the people, I've been following the story for a few years at this point. And Danielle and I met at the White House Tribal Youth Forum in Washington, D.C. She was there with a group of Native youth that were advocating for, you know, environmental issues, like all these different things that they were there to talk with people on. At the time, it was the Biden administration, about some of the issues that are impacting their communities directly. And that's when she brought up that they were planning, you know, the Klamath descent, and they were going to be the first people to descend down the free-flowing river. And the first descents of themselves are colonial in that aspect of being the first, right? So they were just really excited to be the original people. You know, they're all from the basin, and they were really excited to do this for their people and for their families. And Danielle, the way that she talks about the work that she does, like you could just see the passion in her face. You know, she literally lights up and like has hard conversations and talks about these different issues, and how she and other youth talked about the stories that they heard from their families, you know, all these years about preparing for this moment and everything, and about how even with the river, there are a lot of, there's a lot of hurt that comes with it too. And one of the sections of the river that Danielle was going down had a lot of pain from their family. One of her dear loved ones had passed away at one of those rocks down the river, and she kept talking about how she was worried about how she would be feeling when they would go through that section. And as they were going through that section, like the other youth that were on the river were like teasing her, and like somebody like helped like splash her with water and stuff, and were just like messing around with her. And then she didn't realize, but she had gone through that section where her loved one had passed. And when she turned back around, she saw all of these kids that were just having fun and laughing, and all about the just the intergenerational healing that came with all of this. And now she said that when she's talking about that section of the river, she doesn't have to have so much pain with that section of the river. Now she has these memories of joy, and these memories of triumph, and these memories of celebration that she gets to share with her future kids and grandkids and all of those things. And I think that's just really special. I heard that a lot from a lot of the different youth, was how excited they are to share these stories with their kids and with their grandkids in the future. Like, this is incredible work, and to know that these kids got to experience this at such a young age, and to imagine where they're going to be when they're 30 or when they're 40, you know, like, these are future tribal chairmen, tribal chairs and leaders of their communities. And what an amazing opportunity to have that experience and to help shift that whole new narrative and to move forward in a good way, you know, and to not have to worry about all of these issues that they've had to worry about for the past multi-generations, you know, for the past over 100 years. And that, like, my biggest takeaway from the story is just the celebration of it all, and the solidarity, and just the happiness and the joy. And that's just so beautiful.
Is there anything else you want to mention?
I would just love to add that we would love for people to read our work, and you could visit all of that stuff at _spelledout.news, UNDERSCORE.news. And yeah, follow us on all of the different social media platforms to keep in contact with us. And if you ever have any story ideas, definitely send them our way. Kenny Hale.
You've been listening to an interview with _ Native News reporter Jarrett Work on his article about the historic Indigenous youth-led descent of the 300-mile Klamath River since it was undeveloped.